Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, everyone. Happy recruiting week.
Happy recruiting week. National signing. Well, for most people listening to it on Tuesday, National Signing Day Eve. Whether you want to or not, this is pretty much what you're talking about this week, and that's why we're having two podcasts. So this is your slightly recruiting, more basketball Monday edition or Tuesday morning edition, where we'll actually be diving into things not recruiting related before Wednesday's all-inclusive recruiting update, once everybody hopefully is in the door and all the fax machines have been worn out on the Syracuse campus.
Yeah, I don't expect this one to be a super dramatic Syracuse signing day. We actually haven't had a really dramatic Syracuse signing day since like 2010, 2011. One of those was crazy, but I think we kind of know the class we have. We'll probably maybe get one or two more guys. There can always be a surprise. I mean, every so often, if someone comes from completely off the radar. But overall, I think we kind of know where we are, and it's going to be more about, you know, evaluation and kind of seeing how this affects the program going forward. And that's even more fun because we, you know, a lot of it's up in the air with a new coach.
Yeah, and you know what? I mean, if anyone could pull anything out of their ass, it's probably Babers, who, you know, had his list. He had his guys that he was, whether he was intentionally putting a list together to target guys when he left for a new school or not. He obviously set lofty goals between him and his staff at Bowling Green, established a lot of connections at great schools with great prospects. And, you know, Stephen Bailey had a great article, about a week ago, where it talked about how Babers really, like, kind of turned over this class so quickly in his image. And it's been impressive, and I'm not sold that the last we hear about the class of 2016 before National Signing Day is a non-offer to Josh White, Adrian Killens staying at UCF, and Stuart Reese picking Mississippi State over us. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't buy it based on the momentum he's been able to build thus far.
No, and like I said, I mean, we've all seen years where, you know, famously, and you know, not the greatest name to bring up this week, but, you know, Doug Marrone found Jay Bromley like 3 months after signing day. There's always JUCO kids that pop up, and, you know, obviously there are positions like defensive, like the defensive line, where Babers could definitely use a, you know, a JUCO player who's a little more polished to step in just for depth. So just because we have a certain number of kids tomorrow and the class is what it is, doesn't necessarily mean that that will be the class that comes to camp in August. It'll, you know, probably be very close, but more and more players get discovered after signing day every year, it seems like, just because of how the recruiting process has gotten with the internet and everything else. So I don't know what Babers' background with recruiting after signing day is. Happens a little nationally, and definitely happened as Marrone and not for our launch. So I don't know if that was major focus more than most people, or if it's something that we from both steps.
Yeah, I think that's pretty dead on. I think in general, you know, we even saw it last year in a not overly heralded recruiting class, that, you know, Scott Schaefer and co were able to bring in, you know, Ted Taylor and Kentarius Womack after the fact. Womack ended up grading out about a 3-star as a quarterback, but we seemed to plug him in a wide receiver and defensive back. He might switch back for all we know. And then Ted Taylor ended up filling in pretty nicely, you know, at linebacker. So I think between those two and there's so many other examples, some you mentioned, I don't think Babers is done by any means, even if we end up with 20 or 21 guys come signing day.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, even so, we're at 21, and I think the number of people expected was like 23 or so. And obviously there'll probably be some guys that transfer after spring, or, you know, even when we get closer to the season starting, that generally happens with these staffs. That's like one of the, like, basically the transfer outs kind of happen within a couple of weeks of the new staff coming on campus and them evaluating and the players evaluating and whatnot. And then right before and after spring, you kind of see which guys don't really fit the system more and guys who maybe don't mesh with the staff well. So there will be more spots open. There's a decent chance we'll be a little bit below the full, like, 85 heading into next year. But it seems like, at least in terms of the recent coaching transitions for Syracuse, this is going to be one of the more full rosters, as opposed to like with Marone team here, and he had his big, you know, if you want to call it running off or, you know, players transferring or whatever. Like Marone, definitely, I mean, you can argue that he did the right thing and that some of those players didn't belong to the program or weren't good enough, but we also saw issues, issues with depth for at least a couple of years after that. So hopefully Babers is dealing with more of a full deck when he starts this season.
Yeah, and, you know, we spent an entire podcast talking about weird kind of depth issues under Scott Schaefer, and I think, you know, we can move on to basketball and then kind of loop back around to recruiting, but I think that there's a lot more to discuss beyond just the names, especially for a team like Syracuse that right now seems to be pretty locked in with theirs. But moving on to basketball, a sport that is currently going on, and Syracuse gave us kind of a nail biter on Saturday. Dan, you were live to witness the proceedings. What were your initial reactions, and how are you seeing things maybe a little bit differently a couple days later?
I think this was like a classic game that Syracuse loses earlier in the year. As I said, I think on Twitter, and I also said it to like people I was with, like that was the most noon game has ever been. Like, it was incredibly sloppy. The referees didn't seem to know what sport they were refereeing. No one could really hit a shot. The big difference between the Georgia Tech game and some of the close losses we had earlier in ACC play and with Hopkins coaching, the guys just seemed like they knew what they had to do to grind out the win. You saw Malachi Richardson, who had his worst shooting day probably in 2 or 3 weeks, really take over down the stretch and ended up with 13 points, I think. And they were almost entirely just getting to the basket, getting to the line. It wasn't a great free throw day for the Orange, but they hit ones down the stretch when they needed them. Georgia Tech did not. The defense was very good. They had some big steals, obviously the one that pretty much iced the game. So the team is definitely improving. And you saw that with the Notre Dame game, which I was also at, which was probably the most complete performance of the year. It's nice that, you know, earlier in the year, unless Syracuse put together like a really good performance, especially during that mid streak where we were losing a bunch, they really struggled to win, even if they weren't getting blown out. Now it seems like they're kind of learning how to win close games, and they're starting to put together some performances that should really scare some of the ACC teams. I saw Vlogger Sodier, the Wake Forest blog, I think had us sits in their ACC power rankings, and I think it's not unfair to say, you know, Syracuse obviously put itself in a hole to start the year, but they're already eighth in the standings in the ACC. I don't think it's unfair to say they're somewhere in that like 5 to 7 range in terms of best teams in the conference, and I don't think a lot of teams want to play SU right now.
Yeah, and you know what? It's wild right now. Like you said, we're eighth. We're at 5-5. We played more games than most teams, if not every team in the conference, league-wise. And the only thing separating us from, you know, Louisville in second is 2 games, though Louisville did beat UNC tonight not handily, but well enough where you have faith that that's not just a fluke result. You know, we were able to beat the teams in front of us, play hard with the teams in front of us that we've faced so far, and I think that's the really encouraging part. I mean, you look at above us, Miami, close loss, Clemson, close loss, Notre Dame, win, Virginia, close loss, Pitt, close loss, Louisville, we haven't played yet, and then North Carolina, close loss. I mean, see, we've said this before, this is, you know, a 14-deep league this year, and yes, Syracuse is kind of anywhere from, I mean, realistically, they could be anywhere from 2nd to 14th, I mean, based on the 2-game gap between where they are in second place. But they could end up finishing the season as a top-half team, even if they go 5-3, which gets them to about a 10-8 record in the league just because of how much parity is there.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it's going to come down to how the committee views the ACC. I think the ACC fans are kind of more into how deep this league is than maybe the rest of the college basketball world so far. Not that their people are bashing it at all, but it just doesn't seem like it's been talked about, which is quite as much as you'd expect. And it's probably not quite as top heavy as like the Big 12, which is awesome at the top with like those 4 teams. But like, I mean, we're starting to see a couple more teams drop out. Wake really, you know, hasn't been great recently.
NC State, I thought they would be way better. And obviously, Cat Barber is great, but the rest of the team is really, really underperformed relative to their talent level. So we're starting to see a little bit more tiering in the ACC. But overall, I think it's still a really deep league. And I think if there's a big bubble, you're going to see a lot of these ACC teams kind of battling it out with one another. So hopefully SU can keep on kind of winning the games they're supposed to, because that could be big, not only just to rack up wins and improve the RPI and everything, but, you know, Florida State could be on the bubble. Even Duke could be on the bubble by the end of the year, and having a win over Duke and potentially one or two wins over Florida State, and even a couple other schools, you know, might end up being really, really big when Selection Sunday comes along.
No, I completely agree. And you know what? I think we can get to the Duke point in a little while, because I know you and I were discussing it a little bit internally on our on the blog Slack page. But yeah, the fact that this bubble is potentially going to be so ACC-centric, based on how a lot of these teams still play one another, a lot of them have played kind of 500 ball over the last couple of months. I mean, you do have to like where a team like Syracuse is playing. I mean, they're 5-1 in their last six games. You know, two of those wins are over ranked teams at the time. I think in general, yes, you're looking at three wins over kind of shoddier squads in the ACC, but at the same time, like, shoddy is all relative. Like, Wake Forest shouldn't be playing as poorly as it is, especially how well it played in non-conference. NC State has enough talent, even with Barber alone, to be better than a 500 team. Like, Georgia Tech is playing, you know, well above its station. Virginia Tech playing well above its station. I mean, we'll see a lot tomorrow night. As long as Syracuse can kind of, I mean, they shouldn't be playing another game, you know, 2 days later, but that's neither here nor there. They are playing the Hokies. They should win this game based on talent level, but because of how the ACC's gone, because of the short porch between games, you know, anything kind of goes. And I know I made the point kind of in the RPI article, you know, Syracuse doesn't have to win out to get to the tournament, far from it, but they do need to win the games that they're supposed to win, and this Virginia Tech game is kind of one of them.
Yeah, and obviously I've seen people bring it up. Vatech, they're you know, only 12-10, but they're a much improved team this year. And Buzz Williams, the last couple of years, has always given us problems, even with far less talented Vatech teams. And they have some really legit players. I mean, Zach Ledet is one of the better forwards in the league. Seth Allen has been a pretty feisty player for a couple of years, so I definitely don't expect it to be a walkover game, especially because of this ridiculous stretch in terms of scheduling. Obviously, Boeheim, you know, has a reputation of being a whiner and whatnot, but I think this is something where he's definitely right. It doesn't make sense to have these games spaced the way they are.
No doubt. So I guess going a little more into the RPI discussion before we get to Duke, because despite the fact this is, yes, a Syracuse podcast, we do talk about other teams sometimes pretty regularly. And besides Tulane, we try to tie them back to Syracuse. Tulane gets to exist in its own bubble, and I think if Twitter polls are binding contracts, we are obligated to discuss Tulane at some point during tonight's proceedings.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I've been trying to think for the last, like, 30 minutes of how we discuss Tulane. It might just be us shouting them out here, because I don't really know if there's a natural way to do that.
Yeah, or we're going to talk about Wavy the Wave, who, that might not be his name, and I don't really care.
I think it's like the Oregon Duck. Like, he's Puddles. I don't care the Duck's a stupid name. He's Puddles.
Yeah, that's, I never enjoy mascots. See, Otto has a first name. His last name is The Orange. That's fine. That's that is indicative of him actually having a personality. Considering that Puddles in particular, the fact that Puddles has such a personality, you can't just call him the Duck. That's just stupid.
No, I always make the point of calling him Puddles. I refuse to limit him to the Duck.
Just to piss off Oregon fans.
Do they not like Puddles?
No, they hate Puddles. Have you seen the blog post decrying the use of Puddles as a name?
No, I haven't noticed that. I'm going to keep on
pissed.
Doing it.
No, they get pissed.
That's funny. That's bizarre.
It's really stupid.
Why is that something people are worked out about? I get, like,
this is college sports.
Puddles is sports, yes.
Yeah. So yeah, a little bit on RPI. So today I kind of put up a post, and then that would be yesterday for those listening, just talking about how a top 50 RPI in a resume Doesn't guarantee you a tournament bid, but at the same time, it comes pretty damn close. And since 2000, I looked, it was 70 teams with the top 50 RPI were left out. In total, that's 90% in and just 10% out. Now, that might be deceptive a little bit, but it gets to be even better for large conference teams who get in an even higher clip. The only notable exception that kind of skewed a lot of the data in there, and I called this out as well, the 2006 and 2007 committees were unmitigated garbage. Syracuse fell victim to them in 2007, excuse me. And Missouri State fell victim, I think, both years. A couple schools fell victim both years. You had 16 teams left out with top 50 RPIs in that two-year stretch. And it really did skew a lot of the data. But other than that, I mean, this was, for the most part, you're looking at 3.5 teams on average outside of those 2 years missing with the top 50 RPI. So especially if you're going to have a strength of schedule, what Syracuse does right now, which is around 28 or so, you're looking very good. You're not guaranteed anything, but you are looking very, very good to make the tournament if you keep things as is.
Yeah, I think at this point, like if Syracuse holds serve and beats, let's say, Vatek, BC, NC State, and then let's say gets either both Florida State or a split with Florida State and Pitt or something like that, I think if we're looking at 2021 wins before the ACC tournament, I have a very hard time seeing a situation in which a Syracuse team, which is playing like its best basketball, the Jim Boeheim factor, which, you know, might not be a huge thing, but they've admitted it's something, and it's streaking at the right time, unless they get like drubbed by a bad team in the ACC tournament or something, I have a very hard time finding, you know, seeing that team not make the tournament.
Completely agree. I think a 20-11 regular season with wins over what's probably going to be a top 10 A&M team, a Duke team that should be improved, a Notre Dame team that'll be improved. And then, yeah, I guess you can throw in UConn in there too. That should be good enough. I think it really just depends on what Duke does from here, whether or not that win counts as a second quality win, or if we're left sweating out a little bit more come Selection Sunday, a la, you know, again, what happened in 2007, where everyone thought that Georgetown win at the Dome was the crowning achievement. And it ends up that it was not enough to kind of put them over the line in the eyes of what was a faulty tournament committee. The one benefit, I guess, this time around is that we beat A&M early in the season, which could be bad or good, and beat A&M on a neutral court in the Bahamas due to our invincibility at neutral site tournaments in the last, what, 7-8 years now.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure if it was you that said it or someone else, but like no one brings up the A&M game. Like when we're playing, even when we're like playing and people are complimenting Syracuse for the recent success, beating Duke, playing tough with UVA and UNC, the Texas A&M game, like they were a top five team last week. They're still in the top 10. I don't see them falling that far from where they are. You know, maybe they finish out around 15. That's an excellent win. And that team wasn't like worse then. It's not like they've gotten progressively, you know, they've shot up. They've been a very good team all year. So that's a win that, it just seems to be flying under the radar. It's like people forget it happened.
Yeah, I mean, every announcer, and yeah, it was me that brought it up. It was every announcing team seems to forget about it. You know, A&M is in the SEC, so people are kind of quick to dismiss it at times, but the SEC isn't, I mean, it's still not as deep as the ACC, and I don't think we should hold it to that standard, but it's definitely better than it was last year when it was just pretty much Kentucky, Florida, and a bunch of scrubs. I think this season, you know, you're looking at a much different animal when you have a very feisty LSU team. You have a Kentucky team that seems to be able to play up to its competition while also losing some games. A Florida team that's not completely cratered. South Carolina that seems to be much improved. There's a couple others in there, too. Like, the SEC is not the trash that it was last season when Kentucky went on that, you know, kind of unprecedented run. So you can't necessarily discount A&M when they played, you know, a good non-conference schedule, and then it proceeded to play a tougher in-conference schedule than some previous SEC teams have had to suffer through.
Yeah, for sure. And I think there's just always a thing of, like, people are going to not believe in an SEC team that isn't Kentucky until, or you know, Florida 5-6 years ago until someone rises up. But I, having watched a decent amount of A&M now, I'm kind of a believer in them. I don't know that they're a top five team or anything, but they're a really well-coached, you know, consistent bunch. So I, having that win, I think, will continue to be a good thing.
I'll be very, very curious to see what they can do, because I feel like everyone just distrusts A&M. I think in both sports, to be perfectly honest, like, well, both major sports. And I don't necessarily think it's fair. I think in football, there's maybe been some moments where they've created moments of distrust outside of, you know, Johnny Manziel's debut year on the scene. But in basketball, I mean, to me, if the AC Law teams couldn't really make much noise in the tournament, I'd be shocked if this one could, and I'd be impressed if this one does over those teams, which I thought were talented, but a much more nationally respected force, not just because of Law, but in general because of just how good of a player he was.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I think the college basketball overall is a much different animal. And then this year, I don't know if everyone saw the wonderful ESPN update today of anyone from Oklahoma to North Carolina could win. Those are the two number ones. So it's not a huge range according to ESPN, but I think it actually is a huge range in real life. And I just don't see a dominant team. Like, even UNC, I haven't been watching the name for a bit, but Louisville was hanging with them. And Louisville's a weird team. But UNC, you know, maybe they have the deepest roster. I kind of like Kansas in that regard, but they don't play well away from home or as well away from home. Kentucky's really young. So they're just, this is one of those years in college basketball where there's really no team that I can like look at and say, yeah, that's definitely the best team.
And then I guess that brings us to the kind of last topic of the first half. And that ties back to what we were talking about earlier with the RPI is Duke. The best team last year, at least according to the shit show crapshoot of a tournament that is the NCAA tournament. They won it all on a team largely based on freshmen and young, and underclassmen. This year, without Emile Jefferson, they really struggled. They've kind of looked kind of shoddy on defense all season. I think that's something they excelled at toward the end of last year. So now that Duke has fallen out of the top 25 for the first time in 8 years, Dan, you kind of brought up a point in our you know, Slack conversation. We can't actually be happy about this, which is disappointing.
No, we want Duke to win, which is weird. But Duke's in trouble. Like, Emile Jefferson, when we beat them and they were losing those games, I really thought Emile Jefferson was, like, the reason or, like, a big reason. And he's a really good player, but he's not, like, he's not their best player. He's, you know, he's a very, very nice forward. That doesn't explain losing 4 of 5 against not exactly the top of the ACC. Miami's a good team. We're a pretty good team. Notre Dame, Clemson. But, like, that's not exactly – it's not like they played UNC twice and Louisville and you know, traveled to Miami or something, and they lost those games. So I'd be very worried if I was a Duke fan. And down the stretch, just starting with the next two games they should win. They're at Georgia Tech, which isn't a gimme. Georgia Tech's a pretty decent team. Their metrics are better than their record. And then versus NC State, who they just handled. But then down the stretch is brutal. Starting on February 8th, they have Louisville, which is always a tough game. Virginia, who's obviously very good, at UNC, at Louisville, versus FSU, which is a pretty good team, at Pitt, which is always tough to play at, versus Wake, and then versus UNC. Like, there's one game in that stretch, and that's at, versus Wake, that I feel pretty comfortable about Duke definitely winning.
And that's terrifying, and it's weird because I don't feel like any of us are old enough to remember the last time Duke was in kind of a this sort of situation. I mean,
it was 95, I think. It was the year that Coach Tay like took a sabbatical. Yeah. And that was the last time they missed the tournament.
Yeah, this is, I mean, you're right. I mean, and that hurt Syracuse for sure. But yeah, you look at this late schedule. And even, I mean, if Jefferson's back by the end of February, the FSU game isn't much of a problem. But if he isn't, that they have 3 7-footers on their roster.
You have Dwayne Bacon who can drop like 50.
Like what happens if Duke has to play small ball against a team with 3 7-footers on him? I don't really see that ending well.
That's a lot of leaning on Plumlee, and it's not the Plumlee you really want to lean on. He's a pretty good player, but that, yeah, I mean, that's a problematic matchup for them if they don't have Jefferson back.
Yeah, I see this year ending very poorly. Like, I mean, we complain about some stretches Syracuse has in ACC play. Considering that the favorite that Duke usually is seen as and is using, the favoritism usually handed, I mean, looking at Louisville, UVA, UNC, Louisville in four consecutive games, two of them on the road, in that 12-day stretch, I mean, that's a joke.
Yeah, just in terms of, like, realistically who Duke will be favored against, and this is like saying based on how they're playing now without Jefferson, they'll be favored what? At Georgia Tech versus NC State versus Wake and maybe versus FSU?
That's like really it.
That's crazy. Like if that all plays out, they'll be 19 and 12 heading to the ACC tournament. That's nuts.
19 and 12, but I'm sure at that point waning computer numbers.
And probably maybe a bye. Maybe, probably not. They'd be close to not having a bye in the ACC tournament.
Yeah, what's their record right now? You figure you
15-6.
And you slated them to lose what, six more games?
I slated them to lose, let's see, versus both Louisville games, both UNC games, Virginia at Pitt. So,
that's
yeah.
Six. So that puts them at 8-10 in league play.
Which will probably state them maybe at eighth if they're lucky, but probably ninth or tenth.
I mean, they could be an opening day game.
So basically what we're saying, Duke fans, buy your tickets today because they just went on sale.
When they're $29.
get your train tickets up to D.C. Yeah. It's going to be a hell of a time.
I know I made the joke today that you'd be watching Boston College lose, but...
You didn't know you'd be watching Boston College lose to a... one-legged Duke by 12.
But you know what? Watch Duke do that.
And then when
get Jefferson back. Proceed to bury Boston College alive by halftime, and then run through the ACC tournament in a way no one ever has before. I mean, they would, and you'd. You'd wanna be amazed by it, and it would help Syracuse at the end of the day, but you'd hate it so much.
So basically, we're calling for Grayson Allen to turn into Shabazz Napier / Kemba Walker.
Yes.
And run through, and probably steal a bid from another ACC team.
almost undoubtedly, and it'll definitely be Clemson.
Oh God, that'd be funny.
As
we said that, it'd probably be us, but the world where Clemson has like their best basketball season in forever and has all these awesome wins, and then they get their bid stolen by a shitty Duke who then goes on to be like an 8 seed. If they win the ACC, they'd probably be like a 3 seed and lose in the first round because Duke sneakily does that a lot.
Yeah, more often than people ever call out, which is weird.
They win the tournament a lot too, but like they've lost a lot of weird first round games. Shouts to CJ McCollum.
I would love to see Duke do all that, help us get into the tournament, and then lose a 4-13 game to Monmouth.
That'd be amazing. The Monmouth bench, their redemption story, since they're kind of having the whole like classic sports, like, all right, we're kind of done with them now thing, even though I think that's unfair.
Oh, yeah. Typical NCAA. And just the news cycle in general.
Yep.
All right, and I think that's a good place to start halftime. Dan, you've actually been drinking quite a bit in the last week.
Yes. So I was up in Syracuse from Thursday till Sunday. And since we had Friday off of no basketball and the Saturday game was early, friends and I decided that we were going to have a little brewery tour of the Syracuse area. So we hit five, if you count Empire, which I will. We went to Middle Ages, and I'm not going to – if I listed everything we drank, it'd be stupid. So I'm just going to take and give you guys the highlights so you can go to Untappd and see everything. I think I tried, and these were mostly like samples. I wasn't drinking pints of all these things because I wouldn't have made it back to New York. But basically, I think we ended up trying somewhere like 35 beers this weekend, plus like drinking some other standbys. But anyway, so we went to Middle Ages. Obviously, I'm sure most of you guys are aware, you know Middle Ages pretty well. One of the newer things they had there, which I liked a lot, was the Jester's Nectar, which is a wheat beer. Kind of, it's like the Swallow Wit. It's a little deeper, a little more fully flavored. I actually prefer it to the Swallow Wit, which I like a lot. So that was nice. We went over to Eastwood, which is kind of near DeWitt. We had their they were doing a thing where they're mostly known for, I guess, IPAs, based on, you know, what people were saying. But they did an all dark beer thing this weekend, where they had eight new or newish dark beers on tap. The two that I stuck out for me was the double milk chocolate stout, which actually I thought compared pretty favorably to Young's, which is the big double chocolate stout that everyone drinks. Really nice and really smooth, and worked really well. And then their Dunkelweizen, which, you know, really nice, full bodied, very complex, you know, some kind of sweeter notes, but also, you know, a very nice blend of flavors, I thought. So then we went up to Red Hawk Brewing, which is a little outside of town. It's actually in like a red barn that you definitely wouldn't know was a brewery. That place, in terms of just like my own personal taste, was probably my favorite of the weekend, just as they're a Belgian brewery.
They're a true farmhouse. They're a true farmhouse style brewery.
Yeah, no, they're a very much a farmhouse like brewery. Like literally, it's in a farm, a barn, and they have like a very small operation, but they get, you know, some really awesome stuff. The couple that I really liked there, they had a winter saison that was really good. They had a farmhouse IPA, which is one of the best beers, definitely probably the best Syracuse beer I had this weekend. Not so bitter. Like the IPA part wasn't like super prevalent. Like, you know, it was there. There were definitely some hoppiness, but in terms of like a farmhouse style beer, really good, really delicious. And then they had this this other beer called the OUD Bruin, which was kind of vacillated between like a being a brown, but also really having some of the same characteristics of a sour, which is really interesting. Apparently, it kind of changed flavors a lot based on when they brewed it and whatnot. So that was an interesting one. We went to Empire. You all know Empire pretty well, but the Two Dragons they have there, which is the one that's brewed with there was some kind of Chinese influence, and it was brewed with tea leaves, I believe, was really interesting. And then Willow Rock Brewing, which is somewhat close to the SU campus, maybe like five, seven minutes from there, from like South Campus. Really solid. The guys are all really nice. They were kind of finishing up. We went there after the DM Saturday. The standout for me there was the Secret IPA, which I think was fairly new for them. Really nice, very citrusy, pretty hoppy, which was good. So, and there were a lot of good IPAs this weekend. And then in terms of things that we drank that weren't Syracuse-based, there was the Single Cut, which is down here in Astoria. They have a pair of beers. One is the Bon Bon IPA, and one was the Bon Bon 2x TNT IPA, which is probably the best AC/DC-themed beer I've ever had. Quite hoppy, but like just super flavorful. And that Single Cut's just making awesome stuff. And then I got to have Stones and Joy By Valentine's Day Unfiltered, which I don't know if you've had yet, but it's really, really good. And Maine Beer Company, their Mo, which is also really, really good. And everything I have had from Maine so far has been really excellent. So they're definitely one to look out for if they have new stuff coming through.
Yeah, you can't go wrong with Maine. I think what makes Maine even better is just the simplicity of the branding. That I think a lot of people... You know, like sometimes an elaborate label will get people. Sometimes a simple label will get people too, though. And I think, you know, Maine has been able to make it just about the beer with that simple label and really, really just hit it out of the park with everything they do, IPAs in particular. Unfortunately, they don't get out here. But every time I'm back east, I make sure to get some of theirs.
Yeah.
I mean, you're,
have you had the Stone yet? Have you had the Stone and Joy By yet?
I haven't had the latest one. I mean, for the most part, it's the same recipe as always. They just, that one was, they did an unfiltered version.
Yeah,
haven't gotten
it was
great
quite good.
Yet. Yeah, I'll
they also did a black IPA, which I also had to try, but I wasn't as big a fan of that one.
The black IPA, I feel like I didn't like them when they first started gaining a little bit more popularity, like several years back. And then I've definitely changed my mind on them. I really did like the Enjoy By Black IPA when I had it around New Year's. But yeah, I definitely need to. And the problem is lately between Brewery Society stuff and then like Smog City and Monkish around here seem to be releasing like special shit probably once a month. I end up putting all my money towards that. It's not cheap bottles. I don't feel like bankrupting myself on booze. But my drinking habits. So realize that it's been a while since we did this, but I'm just keeping it to some of the more recent stuff. Grabbed a six-pack of Pineapple Sculpin last week. Pineapple's rolling out some more fruited versions of their IPAs, and because I'm within 3 hours or so, I get distribution for them here in L.A. Pineapple Sculpin is... I actually like the second bottle better than I like the first one. It's not grapefruit at all, in that it perfectly balances the flavors. I feel like there's definitely more Sculpin than pineapple, but they still do a really nice job, and I have to say it's definitely one that's growing on me, and I'm sure it's going to see the same wide release now that grapefruit did when it took over last summer's drinking for Americans. Others I had, Founders Breakfast Stout. Founders got distribution out here to SoCal now, so I can find Breakfast Stout on my shelves and I don't have to trade for it, and it's still delicious. Now, the best Pilsner produced in Los Angeles County is arguably Smog City's Little Bo Pils. So had that a couple times this weekend. Actually ended up grabbing a growler while hanging out with some friends, and just had that back here while just relaxing, watching TV. Really good beer, really flavorful Pilsner, and you don't have to deal with the overly drunk and overly full feeling of getting some of their more massive beers. Other things that I enjoyed, I had their Spittin' and Cussin'. It was just kind of like a ridiculously like tart Flanders Red. So good. I had that, and it was very much, I mean, pretty much killed my palate for the next like 30 minutes, but in a good way. Would definitely highly recommend that for anyone in the Southern California area. Infinite Wishes, also another Smog City beer, just a bourbon barrel aged stout, delicious stuff from them. I know they actually have, this is just kind of plugging them for later, they have their Cuddlebug, I think it's, I want to say peach and apricot, sour that they've, this is now the third batch they're putting out, and they just announced the bottle release for that. So I'm definitely excited about that when it comes out. But yeah, that's all of my drinking for the week. Figured we'd make this extra long for everybody. That way, Wednesday, we just kind of plowed through recruiting.
Works for me.
So, Dan, I guess looking at, since I know we obviously don't just focus on Syracuse basketball, as we try to frame Syracuse in the context of, the larger college basketball discussion, just do our usual, kind of crapshoot. Where do you see Syracuse bracket-wise right now? And then maybe who are your four Final Four teams, let's say, based on... I mean, this is not foolproof by any means. I actually think Lenardi's ratings might have started to veer a little bit sideways in recent years. But kind of based on his bracketology, how could you see those brackets playing out?
Let me pull that up. The more I think about it, like, as I said before, there just isn't a team that really jumps out. So I think this could be a year where you have some serious craziness. I think, let me see, in the South, he has Oklahoma as his one. He has Xavier as his two. This is last week's. Damn it. I don't know why that was.
Yeah, it did the same thing to me, where it loaded up last week's first.
Stupid. I saw UCLA. I'm like, wait, they're supposed to be playing us. In the South, I want to take Virginia, but like they're kind of coming close to that. Like, I don't know that this Virginia team is quite as good as the last couple. And that might not matter, just as college basketball probably doesn't have the top end teams as good as the last couple years. But I think they'll still, it's not like they haven't been advancing. Like, they've been playing pretty well. It's just they haven't gotten over the top. At risk of being boring, I kind of like Oklahoma. I think they profile really well as one of those teams that has like the one superstar who kind of leads the way, but also has a really nice blend of talented guys and interesting still players around him. I don't think they have another bona fide star outside of Buddy Hield, but they have like five or six really, really good players who fill their roles well. It's lazy to compare them to like the 03 Syracuse team, because obviously Hield is not Carmelo. he's a very different player. But, you know, the way that that SU team kind of everyone fit their role by the end of the year, and they had, you know, kind of the one superstar and a bunch of really nice players. Like, that's kind of what Oklahoma looks like to me. And Buddy can just dope. Like, Buddy can beat teams by himself. He's unbelievable. So I'm going to go with Oklahoma. Over in the East, UNC, I think they are probably one of the two or three deepest teams. They have interior presence that not a lot of schools have. They just don't seem – I don't know. They don't look to me like a dominant team. But this seems to be a fairly easy bracket that Lenardi gave them here. Florida VCU could be tricky in the second round. Baylor, you know, is kind of an enigma this year. Purdue has looked pretty good. Iowa State, I'm not falling in that trap again. And Xavier, I like Xavier. I don't really know what to make of them as a, you know, a contender for a title. So I'm sticking with UNC.
I don't like him in that game.
Yeah, definitely not in that game.
No, I don't like him in that first round game that Lenardi's got.
Oh, the UAB. UAB is pretty good. And even Michigan can, like, turn it on at times. So I hate being all chalked there. In the West, does that stream to you like, you know, maybe Louisville does the thing they do every so often and comes out of it, even though they're not that great?
Yep.
Monmouth is tough. West Virginia is tough and has, you know, some background with Louisville in terms, you know, when they were both in the Big East. I'm not buying Nova yet. Just as Nova obviously has burned a lot of people a lot. Zona is talented, but, you know, I don't think this is a great Zona team. Michigan State's kind of fallen apart recently. I like A&M. I just don't think they're quite as talented as Louisville. I could see Louisville's style giving them a lot of issues. So I'm going to take Louisville. And then over in the Midwest, where Syracuse is seated as a play-in game against UCLA in just one of the most ridiculous regions I've ever seen. You have Iowa number one. You have Pitt and UConn playing in the 8-9 game. You have a Kentucky versus UCLA Syracuse winner. You have then Miami at 4, Indiana at 6, Duke as a 7, which just seems pretty high, playing Cincy, and then Kansas at the 2. I like Kansas coming out of here in this, but, like, that's just – it's like they just went, all right, we're going to just give the Midwest all the storylines and all the, like, kind of silly matchups. There's, like, so many named teams in there, and I feel like Lenardi just kind of had fun with that one. I like Kansas. I think it's in Kansas has the most really, really good players. And I know I'm probably going to regret that when, you know, Cincinnati or Duke, you know, turns into, you know, Cincinnati drags the Demon in the Mud or Grayson Allen goes for 40. But I just think as long as Kansas can kind of find themselves away from home, I think they're probably the most scary teams in terms of raw talent.
Yeah, you know, I think that this year has the potential to either be just a you know, tournament that's a complete zoo, or because there's so much parity that the best team with the best coaches and the best players just happen to push themselves forward. Say doing the same thing. Looking at the South, Oklahoma's the one seed there. That Dayton and Providence probably hate the fact that they'd be matched up in the second round, because I don't think it does either of them any favors. I think that either of those teams could go far if they were in a different part of the bracket. But I see Oklahoma being able to get past this whole group pretty easily. I see Virginia being able to actually get to the Sweet 16, but, you know, they'll lose to Maryland for sure. I just think Maryland, you and I both like struggle with appreciating the talent on the Maryland roster while acknowledging the fact that they just can't seem to pull it together in bigger moments. I think in Oklahoma, Maryland, you know, regional would be a lot of fun, but I do see Oklahoma winning that game. North Carolina gets a joke of a bracket. I mean, you can just put them right into the regional game with this group for sure. There's too many flaws on Purdue and Baylor. San Diego State's not at all what they've been in previous years. Same thing goes for VCU and Florida. USC, I hate them being at 6 here. I wish I could flip-flop them and Michigan, because I would take USC getting to at least the Sweet 16 in a game against Iowa State. Instead, I'm going to have to slot in a North Carolina-Iowa State regional, but you watch out for USC. I think that they're a very, very good team, and one that could, you know, definitely pull an upset over Iowa State. I would disregard everybody in the bottom part of this bracket. Michigan, no shot. Washington, no shot. UAB could potentially beat any of those other three teams. I guess if you were looking for a 14 or higher team that could get to the second weekend, I think that's one possible candidate in UAB. Although I try not to pick 15 seeds wherever possible, just for the sake of odds say no, and you could really royally screw your bracket.
Unless Georgetown's the 2, and then you pick the 15.
Yeah, and then you always pick the 15. And if it's Florida Gulf Coast, you also put all your money on Florida Gulf Coast immediately. Over in the West, like you said, this is a really stupid bracket. It kind of hinges on Texas A&M. There are three teams that could win this bracket. Maybe four, but I'll start with three. Texas A&M, who should get a bit of a cakewalk if Michigan State can lose. Because as we all know, Michigan State can do some really stupid things when it comes to March in a good way, and upset a lot of people's brackets, a lot of people's expectations. Michigan State, if they do what they normally do, can probably get past most of this part of the bracket and get themselves to another Elite Eight. Lenardi does a fun thing here that you might have picked up on but didn't mention. The Texas A&M game in round two, it could potentially fall in Oklahoma City. That would be a hell of a lot of fun.
Did they wind up playing in the Battle for Atlantis? I forget.
I don't think so. But Texas lost.
Yeah, you're right. I wasn't sure if they had played in like round one or something. I knew that was one of that, and then obviously us and UConn, but like the games that they were kind of setting up for.
Yeah.
But Texas wasn't very good to start the year.
No. They've definitely gotten better, and I think the Zags, I mean, I'm always, the Zags are another team, I'm just always aboard the slander train. I just feel like there's just an overrated nature about them that I'm never a big fan of. I just think that, you know, like, talent-wise, they're usually about two deep, and sometimes that two can do a lot for them, and others it can't. I don't trust the Zags, and no one else should either. And then heading out to the Midwest, this bracket's wild enough that despite all the names, you could end up with none of them getting through. Unfortunately, I see Connecticut being able to get itself to the Sweet 16. I see them probably facing Miami and probably beating them. That's the kind of shitty thing here because now I've got Connecticut in the Elite Eight. I see Valpo and UC Irvine both getting themselves to the second round. I actually think that you're probably looking at...
Green.
Yeah, probably. You're looking at peak Green, but you're also looking at... a Duke-Valpo game that then sets up Duke-UConn in the most miserable regional we've ever witnessed. Because either way we lose as fans, I'd pull for Duke. I'd pull for Duke, but I'd hate it so much.
That's like maximum narrative.
Peak narrative.
I just don't think UConn's that. I mean, this is the worst thing in the world to ever say. I don't think UConn's that good. And, like, we knew what Kemba Walker and Shabazz Napier were. We just didn't think they had the players around them. I don't think they have that guy.
Yeah, but just look at this bracket.
I know.
I mean, at the same time, the shoddiness of the top of that bracket sets up, if Syracuse was staying there, I doubt they would, possibly gain some momentum against UCLA, knock off an inflated Kentucky team. Maybe Stony Brook pulls an upset. You beat them. Suddenly you're in the second weekend against a Pitt team you've played at least twice, maybe three times, or a UConn team you've already played and beat.
Yep. Or Iowa, who I think is a nice team, but they don't scare me.
No, they're my annual one seed that will lose before the second weekend. By far, if this is what they're... I mean, these are the worst one seeds I've ever seen, if past North Carolina and Oklahoma.
Yeah, it's that's just the year it's going to be. I mean, my picks were, like, kind of chalky, but, like, it's really hard to project. I think it's going to be a fun tournament. I'm excited for the tournament a lot. I'm very excited for the tournament.
Yeah.
Because I think it's just going to be mayhem.
And honestly, I didn't even mention West Virginia out west, but I'll
leave they're pretty good.
Out. Yeah, I'll leave them out for now. Because this could be either the year that Louisville shits the bed in round one or the year that Louisville goes further than they should. And yet, maybe last year was the latter. So now we get the former, that Louisville also doesn't get credit for how many times they lose in the first round.
So. Yeah, it's like if you win enough like good tournament games, it totally offsets like you doing stupid things.
Yeah, like Kansas exists in that middle ground where like you always expect them to do good things, but you always know they're gonna let you down. But yeah, I'm gonna have to go with a Final Four of, and I'm gonna hate myself for it. Oklahoma, North Carolina, Michigan State, because Tom Izzo. Devil Magic, and Duke. In the dumbest, like, I mean, this would just be like last year's, actually. Like, the dumbest, most blue blood, like, it doesn't matter, like, the seeds didn't work out for it, it shouldn't have happened, and instead you ended up with the dumbest, most blue blood Final Four you could have. And we're going to get it again.
Sigh.
I don't like it. But sorry, there's an alarm going off behind me, so hopefully that's drowned great. Out. It's really drowned out more.
Alarm.
It's not mine. it's an alarm on my wife's phone, and it's very loud. And she is, of course, in the shower, so she cannot get it. And I am tethered to my computer because we are hardlined in for these things so that the call quality can stay good. Hopefully, it will stop soon. But moving on, recruiting. We have some time to chat recruiting before Wednesday, when we are going to be, as mentioned, 100% recruiting. Dan, what do you make of the situation with Stuart Rees? Do you feel that, obviously no one was really surprised, but what happened last week that took Syracuse from clubhouse favorite on just about every service to... this thing's a laugher, and I don't even know why we're bothering with an announcement, because everyone knows it's going to Mississippi State.
I just think it seemed like it was pretty close, and then I'm always weary of not getting the last visit or the last, you know, OV, and he obviously came up here a couple weeks ago, and Mississippi State kind of got last word in. Obviously, they're closer. They have the SEC to sell, which is tough. So, there's no real shame in it. It's tough, but... I'm not gonna get too worked up over losing him and the other two guys that we missed out on today. One of whom didn't offer, so it's hard to get too worked up about that. Even though I thought he was a good player, Josh White. But overall, I mean, you know, we weren't gonna go like 13-for-13 to end the year. That was just unrealistic. So I think we still can be very excited about what happened a couple weeks ago. And sometimes you're gonna lose players to SEC teams, and you know, Dan Mullen, who's been. I know that Mississippi State isn't the best SEC team, but the job Dan Mullen's done there is kind of miraculous. So going to play for him, no real shame in losing a guy to that, even if Stark Vegas is not the most exciting place in the world.
Yeah, and I mean, it's the power of what SEC can do. I'm not going to go into – and because I don't think this is the case here at all. Folks do the usual, dollar sign EC nonsense and talk about paying players. And I refuse to make assumptions of anybody without any evidence whatsoever. I just think that's silly. And the type of stuff that always kind of happens around this time of year, unfortunately. I think Mississippi State's run a very good program under Mullen. I think he's gotten some great talent in there. And I think that, he's brought that program to a place they really shouldn't be, but are. I'm hoping, because this seems to be the case whenever, a non-blue blood starts making some noise in the SEC, that there's always something, but I'm giving the benefit of the doubt that there is not here. And Mississippi State's above board, because you know what? I think they're a lot of fun to watch. I think despite not really running like a true spread or anything like that, they've still been a fun team in recent years, and I don't really have any ill will towards them. I mean, I had convinced myself we weren't getting Rees. I thought we had an official visit the day after Mississippi State did, but since I never heard anything about it afterward, I don't know if it actually happened.
Yeah, it's tough because he's not on Twitter, right, Rees?
No, he isn't, which is, yeah, that's the tough part.
That's where it's tough, because obviously Baby can't say anything, and the coaches aren't going to start floating, their little Drake memes and whatnot if they're not going to win a kid. So I will say, like, to your first point, saying something shady is happening is stupid. Also, Ole Miss and not Mississippi State is the program that has hashtag the network.
Well done.
Yes, I pulled up the Dramatic Chipmunk YouTube video to do that. No, I mean, you lose some recruiting battles. I know after the whole, like, circus that we had a couple weeks ago, we got really worked up about bringing in, like, a top 40, 50 class. But I think for what Faber stepped into and how he, assessed the situation and decided to go about this class, like, the work he's done has been really, really impressive. And I know people can get worked up about, getting rid of players and whatnot, but there are ways that it's done tastefully and there are ways that it isn't. Obviously, Jim Harbaugh's cut a lot of flack for what he's done, and that's a little different because he's coached this team for a year, and he's had these recruits in his class for over a year now, so he had plenty of time to tell people, you don't fit, we are going to go in a different direction, etc. And Babers, to his credit, it seemed like he might be going ghost on some guys, which isn't the best, and I don't love that, but it seems like at the end of the day, he did reach out to these players. He gave them at least a couple weeks to let them know that they probably weren't going to fit the system. And that's just, it's one of the inherent evils of the recruiting process. Unfortunately, and then a lot of those guys, obviously we really don't want to like bash players or anything that's gross. But, it's not like these guys are all going to like Miami or we had one go to LSU and I think we're all pretty happy for him. It's a good story. But they're all players that are, going to group of five schools, going to, not tremendous peer programs. So we're getting very similar, if not better, players. I think we can all be pretty proud of what SU's pulled off. And I'm very excited to see what he does in 2017.
Yeah, and I mean, we've been through this before. But you know what? Like, this is what people need to remember is that he had about 2 months, but to be honest, he had a month to really be recruiting in earnest here. He's done a phenomenal job. You really can't, credit him enough for what he's pulled off in such a short amount of time. That's not to say that every single one of these guys is going to be a stud and that every single one of them is going to be, a program changer. It's a crapshoot no matter who you bring in the door. I mean, there's plenty of teams that have, pulled in a couple four-star type classes in a row and just doesn't work out, just like there's plenty that have. I just think that, Babers, because he's done this before and because Coyle's done this before, there was a plan, and maybe Schaefer needed more time. But when you're a program that was kind of teetering on the brink, I don't necessarily think you could afford the time. So, Schaefer, the fact that he landed at Maryland speaks volumes about, where he stands in coaching circles and administrative circles. I think that if he does well with the Maryland defense over the next couple of years and has them, hanging around 500 or so, a little bit better in the Big Ten's East Division, which is a bear, I think that'll earn him enough looks to either land another major conference job or even a MAC head coaching job, which shouldn't be that hard based on his connections over there. So I think, I'm sure the debate about Schaefer seemed to die off, and that's fine, and I hope it doesn't come back because of this conversation, but, there's something to be said for how Babers has done things, something to be said for how Coyle's done things, and so far, without a game being played, you can't really see this as anything but positive. Once games are played, we'll be more critical, we'll take a look at what's working, what isn't, but right now, there's just a whole lot to like about what we're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, if you have like the most pessimistic view of what Babers has done so far, it's still like really, really hard to argue that the class isn't just as good as what Schaefer would have brought in. And you can say like the one guy who got away, Scott, I'm going to go ahead and say he probably would have still gone to LSU if Schaefer was around and got like an 18-year extension. So, I think we can all be pretty happy. I think Wednesday will... like I said, to top it off, I think it's going to be a fairly straightforward signing day. Obviously, we have a little bit of drama with Nelson, and hopefully he sticks with us. I feel like we might have already heard if he had decided to flip to UGA, but maybe he holds on until signing day. But overall, I'm pretty impressed. I'm very excited about some of these players. And it's actually kind of cool because I think so, a lot of the national folks, even though Syracuse class is still going to finish probably in the 50s somewhere, which isn't generally something that anyone talks about outside of, you know, the program, people seem to be fairly impressed just based on the context of what Baber's stepped into and what he's leaving with, which is pretty much a, you know, an entire overhaul. And I think last time we had a podcast, we talked about like Marone's first class, which turned out to be really good, but he only brought in 13 players with roughly the same amount of time. Babers is going to sign very close to a full class, which is impressive.
Agreed. I think that's a good place to stop us. Obviously, we're going to be right back here on Wednesday after what should be a rewarding signing day for Syracuse. So, Dan, thank you for your time tonight and for, you know, making time for two podcasts this week.
Glad to do it. Strap in for Wednesday, everyone.
Yep. So if you don't want to hear about recruiting, don't tune in. But please, by all means, tune in, because honestly, we're probably going to talk about things that have nothing to do with recruiting, because that's usually what we do here. I'm sure
breaking down Tulane's entire class. I don't know about you.
That sounds like a 10-minute block to me. As always, you've been listening to Troy Noons as an absolute podcast. I'm John. That was Dan. Please be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, whatever service you may be using to listen to us. Comment on the blog post that we use to accompany it. I usually talk about beer in there, but plenty of other crap comes up. And yeah, we'll see you again on Wednesday night / Thursday morning.
Go Chiefs.